The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Football Weekly Extra. Today, Jose Wibble, Arsenal wobble, Liverpool hail Sturridge double, Man City burst Spurs bubble, and Cardiff are in a lot of trouble. We round up all the midweek news up and down the league and look ahead to the weekend's action. Games like Monday's Man City Chelsea, who will be playing 19th century football this time, Jose. There's foreign things, Draxler and the laces from Italy, with Milan signing Tarapt and Inter offering free Freddie Guerin with every club scarf sold. All that and more in today's Football Weekly Extra. Hello, chums. My special friends today are Barry Glendenning.
Hello, Jimbo.
Raphael Honigstein.
Hello.
And Amy Lawrence.
Hello.
Hi, Amy. Husky as ever, I'm delighted to see.
Thank you very much.
Say hello again, go on.
Hello.
Oh, lovely. Hey, you were at White Hart Lane.
I was.
Let's start with White Hart Lane. Man City going top. And it's a bit like Arsenal with a beat cop who were first on the scene of the crime, but Man City, the sharp-suited FBI agents who turn up and say, thanks, Arsene, we'll take it from here, no?
It's quite a good analogy. They were unbelievably strong, and what I really liked about their performance was, you know, you look at the scoreline and obviously another heavy goal fest, but the real beauty of Man City was in the first half an hour when it was only 1-0, rather than in that last phase where it was sort of quite easy for them to knock in a few goals. Tottenham, you know, the game had gone, they'd lost a man with the Danny Rose sending off and so on. But that way that they started the game, and this is where you think, if City are going to have any problems this year, it's probably going to be away from home. So they go away at a match which is billed as one that may test their credentials, and instantly there's this feeling that they're so powerful from kickoff, and it's as if they're just playing really comfortable, composed football, that they're so in their comfort zone, and yet they make their opposition look like they're kind of playing at high altitude and gasping for breath.
Mm.
And it's just that sort of aura that they have now, where I think other teams are now very much aware that they're expecting trouble when they're playing against Man City, and that doesn't augur brilliantly for everybody else.
It certainly doesn't. Are they there to stay, Rafa? On
yeah.
top?
I think the big surprise about City is that it's taken them that long to actually be this good. I think people looked at the squad, looked at Pellegrini coming in after the Mancini mess, and thought this is going to be how the season would be from the beginning. I think the doubts came in when they had these weird results at Cardiff, etc. And people thought, you know, how is it they can't defend? Why can't they get corners right? But, I mean, they're only doing what I think a lot of people expected them to do now. But they're doing it in style, which is nice because, as Matt Dickinson points out in the Times, if you buy the league, you might as well do it in style.
Yeah, but that's exactly the point, isn't it, about Man City, where I think some people have a kind of moral dilemma about them. You know, you want to find it difficult to like what they're doing because of the financial backing that they have, and yet when you watch them play, it's so wonderful, it's difficult not to be seduced by it. So it's difficult to sort of work out how you feel about this Man City team unless you're actually a City fan, which in this case is pretty obvious.
Barry, what do you make of Man City?
I love watching them play from a purely football point of view. Them in full flow was just marvellous to see. I am a bit sniffy about the fact that they've spent almost exactly £1 billion since Sheikh Mansour took over in 2008, August 2008, which, you know, you'd expect them to be top of the league, and it is definitely there to lose. But they scored 68 Premier League goals this season already, compared to 66 they scored in total last season. Woof. And if they keep going at their current rate, they'll get 112, which I would imagine, I haven't checked, but I would imagine that will be a record, a huge record by some amount, although someone may well prove me wrong.
It was nice to hear the City fans singing for their owner at the end of the game last night. They were singing Sheikh Mansour, my lord, Sheikh Mansour.
Would it have made any difference if Spurs had used one of these newfangled defensive midfielder things?
I don't think so. Didn't they have a newfangled defensive?
Well, they brought on Capu at a certain point.
Yeah, they
had a slightly more defensive setup because it was a 4-2-3-1 rather than the crazy 4-4-2 that they have played. But still, Dembele and Bentaleb are not your natural holding midfielders. Dembele is very much a sort of up and down Yaya Touré character almost, but he needs somebody behind him. Ben Taleb is very talented, but he's also very young and inexperienced. Again, I think looking at that lineup, probably they were set up for failure, I suppose.
Right. What about Aguero's injury? How serious is that going
to
be?
Well, they said that it wasn't too serious. They weren't seeming to get panicky about it. But they do seem to be picking up a reasonable amount of injuries. I guess the benefits of having such a deluxe, well-stocked squad, this is where it
counts. Jovetic coming in.
Yes, it was nice to see him, and he scored a deflected goal, but seemed very happy with it. So it kind of gets him ready to get more involved.
And City have a big game coming up on Monday when they're going to be hosting Chelsea at the Etihad. Of course, Chelsea will go all out for the win. There won't be any parking of buses. It'll be three or four up front, I should think, going hell for leather from Jose Tactical Madman Mourinho.
Yes. It was his comments after the game. He's been slightly misrepresented in the papers. His comments have been interpreted as a rant. It wasn't a rant, and he wasn't as hard on West Ham as the selective quotes that have been published would suggest. You know, he sort of went that it's their prerogative to play like that and they need the points in their position, but he wasn't particularly happy that he didn't let his team play.
But isn't the issue that, you know, it might be their prerogative, but yet, on the other hand, when they go away from home to whether it be Arsenal or Man United or whatever and play a similar sort of defence-first approach, it's not their prerogative. He was the one that turned around after the 0-0 draw at the Emirates and said, when their home team doesn't score a goal.
Yeah, Guasam USA, how is Jose complaining that West Ham played negative football today? And he did complain. He then went on to say, you know, I maybe have done that in the past. Is this the most stark example yet of hypocrisy from the parking attendant? Was he at Chelsea's match at the Emirates? Yeah, I think this was his quote that day. I think boring is a team that plays at home and cannot score a goal. That's boring.
Well, I mean, Chelsea as well went to Old Trafford and played no striker.
What about his Inter team when they went to Chelsea or when they went to Barcelona?
And his Porto team, you know. I mean, he's been completely...
Porto team weren't that bad, to be fair.
Well, in terms of time wasting and cheating, they were peerless, I would argue, particularly when they won the Europa League.
I think it's all part of the new Jose, who sort of is the defender of British values and doesn't like diving and all these things that his teams would never do. And I think, to be fair to him, he knows that he's being hypocritical. And it's almost sort of a self-caricature.
Hmm.
But what I think was a little bit too much was when he said West Ham's objective was not to come and play here, etc. You can say all that, but then he said they didn't want to feel part of the quality of the Premier League. I think that's a bit. That's a bit.
He also accused them of 19th century football.
Yeah, when I heard that, I thought, oh, they must have played in extra long shorts with shirts with laces pipes in the collars, flat caps, pipes. You know, parking the Hansen cab. But anyone who has read Inverting the Pyramid, and I've yet to finish it, but I got far enough into it to learn that apparently in the 19th century, teams played very attacking football, often with only one defender.
Yeah. Well, as people point out, there were two different schools of thought. I think there was the English, passing is for the weak-willed, and we would just run until our shins are hacked to pieces. They would form an orderly line, I think, and charge at the opponents. And then the Scots came up with this very devious plan of actually passing from one side of the pitch to the other. But again, they were both quite offensive. Anyway, extraordinary stats there about that game. It was 0-0. West Ham had one shot, which was on target. Chelsea had 38 shots, 9 of them on target, and that's apparently a Premier League record for a team that's failed to score, having 38 shots, 9 on target. Why didn't they score, Rafa?
Because, as Jose said, they played with 5 defenders. They had more goalkeepers than defenders. I don't know what that means, but it's great. Look, I think it's easy to say they were missing Mata, or they're missing that, or they're missing this, and this is a problem with the strikers. This is a sort of game that can end 5-0, 6-0, or 3-0, or once out of 20 times, it can result in a fluke 0-0 or even a 1-0 to the opposition. It happens in football that you just don't take your chances. I don't think there's any big conclusions to be drawn from that.
Okay. Wasn't Big Sam quick to take the credit again for out-tacticking Jose with his team's heroic backs to the wall performance?
Well, it was a great point for West Ham, no?
Oh, no, it was, of course, yeah. But I think,
of course, he's allowed to enjoy it.
Yeah.
It's not a significant setback then, this, for Chelsea?
It's significant in terms of points, but right. I don't think it necessarily suggests that there's something fundamentally wrong with Chelsea. Yes, they have slightly fewer firepower up front mm-hmm. compared to City, but everybody else has, probably everybody else in Europe has. Yeah, are they still good enough to win the league? Yes, I think Monday now puts a bit more pressure on them. Maybe it's good for the game that they will not really go to that game thinking a draw will be totally fine for us. They'll take the draw, because Mourinho always does in these games, but looking at the table, they're under a bit more pressure to maybe try and
maybe go for it. And what do you think then? City at home scored, what, about 6 billion goals? Absolutely unstoppable at home. Can Chelsea do something at the Etihad Monday night?
Well, if Chelsea get a 0-0 draw, I think they'd be extremely pleased. I mean, that's the, you know, of course they can do something, and their intention, quite rightly, needs to be to go and get a point, which is what Mourinho has
really?
Been doing. Of course it should.
I thought the accepted wisdom was that to beat City at home, to have any chance, you have to do what Liverpool did and really go at them.
Well, we'll soon find out, because, I mean, it may well be that Chelsea take that tactical approach, but it would be unexpected, let's be honest. I mean, are we not thinking that Chelsea are going to go up there and be extremely glad to try and smother the game as much as possible and take what can be be grasped?
Yeah, we are.
I think the way to beat City is to keep the ball against them and expose them by passing around and making the guys in the middle run a lot. Chelsea are not a team set up to do that under Mourinho. So they have to go very direct, and they probably do so from a very deep position and then try to feed off some scraps, which they do very, very well. I'd say they're the best counter-attacking team in the Premier League, maybe even in Europe right now.
Chelsea, the best counter-attacking team in Europe?
Who else is better?
I don't know. I mean, there's loads of people who are good at counter-attacking.
Don't forget, Sunderland beat Manchester City.
Yeah.
And regularly beat them.
Yeah.
It's not that difficult.
All right, then. Yeah, it's a fair point, Barry.
There was a small period in the game last night when Tottenham rattled City a little bit, actually. Admittedly, it didn't last. But in the period just before half-time, the game became quite even. It became a little bit bad-tempered. And when it became bad-tempered, City sort of lost their composure slightly. And whether that's something that Chelsea will look at, it was just a moment within the game. But it definitely changed the balance. And suddenly, the slickness in City wasn't there. They got a bit upset. There was a few bad tackles. And then, of course, Tottenham had a couple of bad incidents just after half-time, which also impacted on the game. And
Danny Rose sending off and the goal that was disallowed.
Exactly. And the goal that was pretty unfortunate to be disallowed. And although, if you were to say how much that would affect the game, and it's hypothetical, I still suspect City would have cranked it up to win. You know, we never know. But it was at least an insight that for kind of 5 or 10 minutes on either side of half time,
it was a chink in their armour, was it?
Their own way.
Good. That's it for part one, eh? Where's the Arsenal chat? It's hiding just behind this. Hey, producer Ben's positing that Arsenal might be the best counter-attacking side in the league. What do you think about that, Amy?
Not without Walcott.
All right, that's a
fair
point.
There's no pace up front.
All right, Rafa, yeah, that's a fair point. They got held by Saints 2-2. Could have been worse, Amy. Could have been worse.
Could have been worse. Could have
had
been
had Sam Gallagher, you know,
yes.
That open goal.
Yes, that was an incredible chance. I thought Southampton were terrific, actually.
Yeah, back and to their best, no?
Well, when they played at Sunderland recently, they went 2-0 up.
Sunderland.
There,
I don't know
right.
What this other club is you're talking about.
Okay, that team anyway. When they played up there not so long ago, and they went 2-0 up playing brilliant, pressing, aggressive football. And then they put so much energy into that first period that they sort of, when their levels dropped, it allowed Sunderland to come back into it and draw the game. So, yeah.
To be fair, in that first half, they might as well have been up against 11 training cones and should have put the game to bed by halftime easily.
Okay.
Fair point.
But they started in a similarly, you know, terrific.
No, but
are
you talking about the Arsenal game? Because Arsenal was similarly training cone-esque, were they not?
They were very sluggish in the first half as well, yeah.
Right. Okay. Is it February or something? Because here we are, Arsenal just fallen off the top of the table, tough run of fixtures coming up, and everyone's predicting the massive jelly leg collapse.
Who knows? I mean, they have a lot of... look, the thing about this league is that going into this these fixtures just now,
yeah,
Man City, Arsenal and Chelsea had all won, five league games in a row? there was a relentlessness about everybody winning every game, and you get to a point where the standard is so high and the expectancy is that everybody is powering on, three teams going for it. If you draw a game away from home, it's a disaster.
Right.
So you've got to have a little bit of perspective and say, well, you're not going to... It'd be unusual to go through every game and not occasionally not quite be at your best. And a point away from home at Southampton shouldn't really be a catastrophe, but set against the way that City are playing, it obviously looks that much worse.
I'm not sure I like this perspective business. Can we have some Arsenal in crisis? Look, Flamini's got banned for what, three games?
Four, and
got,
I think.
Four, and they've got huge games coming up, Amy.
Yes. I mean, they've got two sets of massive games coming up, a February tranche and a March
tranche
as well. Yeah. The February one is slightly easier because three of the four games are at home.
Right.
And the March one is really, really daunting because they're nearly all away from home.
But Flamini's out for the majority of this February tranche.
Yes, but not only Flamini, the lack of Ramsey, who was expected to come back, is a really big loss as well, probably a bigger loss than Flamini.
So he was back in training, but now something else has happened.
I think the same muscle that had been bothering him was aggravated again.
Ooh.
And we'll soon find out by the end of tomorrow night, but I think that may force Arsenal to be a bit more desperate in the last day of the transfer window, she says, looking at Raphael Honigstein.
We go now across to our Bundesliga correspondent, Raphael Honigstein, for the latest on that Julian Draxler to Arsenal story.
It's a little bit mystifying because you have two different clubs putting out two completely different versions of what's happening. Arsenal, and I suspect Julian Draxler's people as well, are saying this deal is on, it can be done, very close, a few millions here and there, but we can find an agreement. Schalke is saying, no one's calling, no one's been to see us, I don't know what you're talking about, we have no interest in selling him in January.
Right. Arsenal have Dick Law, their chief transfer negotiator in Germany, to explore the possibility. You can't argue with Dick Law.
The thing is, he doesn't like to argue. There are all these fantastic stories flying around from last summer where he turned up at various clubs, delivered a first and final offer, and then left again with a polite wave.
Right.
And they never heard from him again. So I don't know. I mean, yeah, that's a strong way to do things, but doesn't always get it done. The word from Schalke is that the fabled delegation never turned up yesterday. And I see some UK papers have said, well, we actually didn't say that. We just said that talks are ongoing. Talks are ongoing. I think that is fair to deduct. The problem is, I think, what's happened here is that Schalke have kind of outsourced this business to a friendly agent or two to have enough plausible deniability to say, we're not involved, we haven't heard from anyone, don't know what you're talking about. And the expectation, certainly in Germany, is that a deal is being done, but probably not for January, simply because Schalke are not in a position where they have to say, you know what, the guy's going to go in the summer, let's get less for him now, just to make the deal happen now. All the indications are that they've tried to haggle and not say, we're coming with the £45 million, where at that point Schalke have said, I don't see why we should do the deal.
What intrigues me is that when you look back at Arsenal's deal for Ozil, that came about basically because they were so desperate. And it was completely out of character the way they negotiated for that deal. Your image that you depicted of Dick Law's modus operandi is probably, you know, quite a nice way of explaining how he tends to like to go and say, this is what we're prepared to pay, and cheerio if that doesn't go down well. The kind of negotiating aspect seems to get lost a bit sometimes in translation. So whereas with the Ozil deal, clearly there was no time to mess about. They knew what they had to pay, and they, against their probably better judgment, knew that there was no bartering to be done and got on with it. Now, have they learnt from that? Because if they want to sign Draxler now, they have to do the same thing. They can't be expecting that they can undercut his escape clause.
To just underline what Amy has said, I think it was really interesting to read in some of the papers, I think yesterday, saying that Arsenal are not quite sure whether €45 million is the right price for a 21-year-old midfielder. Yes, I understand why they're not quite sure, but this has only dawned on them now, on the 30th of January. I mean, that's been the situation since last summer.
Where do the papers get that sort of story from, Rafa?
ask Amy.
Amy, where do the papers get that sort of story from?
What, the sort of story of...
Why not being sure whether they should...
Is Arsenal putting that story out to cover up cover any failure in the end to land Draxler or explain the delays or what?
Well, I don't know who's been talking to who because I haven't heard it, so okay. I'm pretty useless there. Sorry.
Yeah, it's a leak from Dick Law, yeah. says producer Ben.
Is he drip-feeding information?
I don't know. I really
He's not very excitable, unfortunately.
Right. Let's move on because there were other big games this midweek. And some very big games in prospect for the relegation battle at the weekend. So let's bosh through a couple of these. And Liverpool, what a win that was in one of the biggest Merseyside derbies for decades, with both teams challenging for a Champions League place. And Liverpool coming into this game with all sorts of players out, but absolutely destroying Everton, Barry.
Yeah, they put the hurt on them in a big way. We should probably point out Everton were missing some key players as well.
That's
and
true.
I think the absence of Seamus Coleman was he was a big loss for them because it gave it nullified one of Everton's main attacking threats down the right, particularly as Liverpool's left back, Sissoko, had a shocker, even though his team won 4-0. And... it also gave Liverpool an avenue down which to attack because Everton had quite an inexperienced young lad playing instead of Coleman.
Mm. Indeed so. Sturridge, how about that second goal?
Yeah, it was beautiful. Mm. It was an amazing goal. The guy has incredible talent, sometimes a bit too much confidence, but when he plays in a team that works around him, I think he's... pretty, pretty good.
A massive success then for Liverpool. But was this the night that the honeymoon finally ended between Suarez and Sturridge? The way those two fell out seemed to go on forever and ever. I was surprised it wasn't picked up on more. And then Sturridge, when he was taken off, had a bit of a go with Brendan Rodgers. I'm surprised that wasn't... because they really did have words again and again after he decided to do his little spin and fluff as opposed to servicing Suarez.
Yeah, but I mean, if it had been a defeat or a draw, then I think I would understand that. But I think in the context of a 4-0 win, you probably can argue that to have, you know, two of your main attacking players who are so desperate for the ball and to do something with it shows how much they care about how they're playing is not necessarily the end of the world. It's probably better if that kind of... discussion is off the pitch afterwards so they can have a little go at each other and then kiss and make up, but I don't think it's the end of the world that happened on the pitch.
All right, well, we'll see.
There's always been a suggestion that Sturridge is a bit big for his boots, and I saw a photo of him posing alongside his new Ferrari this morning, which would suggest that might be the case, but my other broadcasting partner, the man I see behind your back at weekends, Max Rushton, knows
you don't have to see him behind that
Daniel
back.
Sturridge quite well and assures me that he's a really, really lovely fella.
I, on the other hand, am a top friend of his uncle's.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, who does say he needs to smile a bit more in public.
Okay.
He was also contrite straight away. They pulled him up for the interview.
Was he?
Post-match, and he straight away...
No, I don't want to make a big thing of it. It's just that everyone had talked so much about what a great feeling and understanding they had, and nobody was expecting... They were expecting them to be a bickering from the word go. And on this occasion, they really were after that, and I just wondered if maybe, you know... But anyway, let's move on. And Mr. November says, any chance of some pod-based love for little Pip Coutinho? While Sturridge and Gerrard rather predictably got the plaudits, I thought Coutinho playing in a slightly deeper central midfielder role was a real star. Not only was his use of the ball excellent, but he pressed and harried in a manner I didn't think he was capable of. Yes?
I couldn't disagree with the words of that.
All right, OK. Liverpool are apparently going to buy that Conny Palanca. Is that... Do I pronounce it like that? Rafa, you're good with names, foreign ones.
I don't know. I'm not Ukrainian. Why are you asking
me? Right, because, you know, you've been
around.
Konoplyanka.
I think it is. Yeah, but there was a suggestion that two unnamed Premier League teams may be out to wipe Liverpool's eye again. One of those unnamed teams being named Tottenham Hotspur.
Ah, that's interesting, isn't it? As they head towards this game with West Brom, of whom we'll speak in a second or two, Everton now have Lukaku set to miss... A week or two with his ankle or longer, do you think, Amy?
It's a few weeks, apparently.
A few weeks,
yeah,
is it?
They were worried it was going to be long term. But
my, you are husky, Amy.
Yeah. And Irish.
Yeah. Right. Okay, well, I'll tell you what, let's mention West Brom because they face Villa in an absolutely extraordinary West Midlands derby. Villa had only scored 8 goals at home all season. Now. Yeah,
it was nearly 2-1 that there would be more than two goals in this game. And there ended up being 7. There was over two goals in the first 13 minutes.
Mm.
And Villa went 2-0 down, ended up winning 4-3. Diego Lugano had a shocker in the heart of the West Brom defence. I think he gave away a goal, missed a sitter, conceded a penalty and got booked for dissent.
Mm.
And that's good news for England, I suppose, because he's the captain of Uruguay.
Right, whereas Jagielka's performance against Suarez is rather less positive tidings. This was the kind of game, this derby, that Jose Mourinho would really be happy with. It really embodied all the Premier League values, didn't it?
It certainly did, in the manner of sort of craziness and lack of...
goals going in off people's
real
faces.
Defending, yep. And stuff.
I mean, and Delph's goal as well.
I think, yeah. I mean, he's a fabulous player. I think the real story is really the reawakening of Christian Benteke. Only 6 months after the close of the last transfer window, has suddenly realised, I'm actually still playing here. I might as well get on with it. And they are a completely different team. I mean, I really remember so vividly watching them against Chelsea, which was an early game, I think fairly close after a 3-1 win at Arsenal. And they looked... really exciting. They had sort of a power, a physicality about it. They were quite young, fairly fearless, very direct, not pretty in a continental sense, but incredibly forceful. And with Benteke in the mood to play football, they're a very different side.
Well, whatever it is, it's working. And how about Man United Cardiff when we're talking about big games midweek? Wow. Barry, what was your headline story on this? Because there's so many to choose from.
Well, what I thought was interesting about the game is that all the newspapers sent sort of two reporters along, one to report on the game and one to report on Juan Mata.
Mm.
But unfortunately, he didn't really oblige and had a fairly unremarkable first game for United, which is completely understandable because he's only been there, hadn't trained with his new teammates or whatever.
But surely his very presence lifted the atmosphere.
Oh, of course it did, yeah. Mm. And he got a standing ovation when he came off.
He didn't bang the seat this time, did he?
No.
And Wayne Rooney got a standing ovation when he came on.
Yeah. And
there you go.
That's what a couple of transfer requests and...
Robin Van Persie played, and David Moyes, before the game, had he basically, I think he's the meek David Moyes of old, the sort of quivering, I'm actually out of my depth here, David Moyes, seemed to have disappeared, and a new, more forthright David Moyes, who's vowed not to put up with any more nonsense from his underperforming players, made himself known, and it was a delight to see, because it's about time he stuck up for himself. And
I must rebuild this team,
yeah.
He was saying.
The thing is, the problem is, a lot of managers don't do that because it's dangerous if you expose the players in front of the media for some of your own failings. They tend not to like it that much and then brief against you, and then, you know, suddenly you see in the papers that the managers are not there from Monday to Thursday. I mean, I'm not saying Moyes isn't. I think he's actually a very good manager, but this sort of thing happens. That's why lots of managers will not say anything bad.
Also,
I mean, let's not forget they were playing the worst team in the division. Van Persie on the pitch is like Benteke. He's a transformative figure, makes everybody play a little bit better. Simply the movement creates space, creates also an intensity that Man United have been lacking. They've been so pedestrian. But if a guy comes, moves, gives it back to you, the rhythm of a game changes, and then the lesser teams like Cardiff just cannot keep up with it.
Right.
So I think Mata is interesting because he has very little pace, very intricate. Does he really give United that factor that they've been so missing on the flanks in, well, of recent years, you could argue? I'm not quite sure. I mean,
flanks were the one place they had oomph.
I think that's very hit and miss. Valencia will have one good game, then two very ordinary ones. Nani, I don't know where he is. I don't know if he's still a footballer, if he's at Inter already.
Yep.
I don't know what he's doing. It's just for Man United, a team that were built on strength on the flanks, is very average in my view. And I don't think that Mata will change it. He will, of course, change the overall quality of the squad, but they need a few more, and I think Moyes realises that they need a few more players of that calibre before they really start having a big impact.
Lovely goal from Ashley Young, though.
Yeah, that's true.
On
the flanks.
It's true. Solskjaer asked after the game what was the most difficult thing for you during the match, and he replied, not celebrating when Man United scored, which I thought was rather sweet. How much trouble are they in, Cardiff?
Lots, I'd say.
There you go. Right.
Well, teams above them seem to be sort of motoring upwards, and they're, you know, it's a bit too early to say because Solskjaer hasn't been there long enough, but I would say they're in quite a lot of bother.
Big trouble. Although, in their next game, which is at home to Norwich, they can use Fabio Zaha and Kenwyn Jones. Transformative players, ahoy.
The Kenwyn Jones, Peter Odemwingie swap was a bit weird, in my opinion. Sort of like one bad dressing room influence being exchanged for another.
Right. But they're home to Norwich.
You want just the right sort of bad dressing room influence.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm not sure either are the right sort.
Right. Well, that's coming up this weekend. In a second or two, I think we're going to have another little bit of music. We'll address those relegation battles. Tum-tum-tum-tum-tum-tum-tum. Relegation battles. Yes, Swansea will travel back in time to a world of chimney sweeps and penny farthings to face oldie-worldie West Ham this weekend. Swansea, of course, coming off that win. Hey, their first win in eight. They beat Fulham. Huzzah. I mean, not if you're a Fulham fan.
There is a team in big, big trouble.
Right. Well, let's have a look. Where are Fulham now? They're in the bottom three. It's Fulham, West Ham and Cardiff. Cardiff 1 point worse off than the two Hams. And then above that, 2 points clear of the dropper. Sunderland, who are outside. We'll come on to Sunderland in a second because they've got the biggest of all these games. They're on 21 points. Stoke on 22. West Brom on 22 as well. Swansea, yeah?
No, I was just saying, I mean, looking at the table, I'm actually really surprised to see Swansea City and Villa comfortably mid-table. But it's a bit deceiving because everybody down from below Southampton is effectively fighting relegation, and that's half the league. It's strange.
Yeah, 11 teams.
I can't remember
teams.
League being set up in that way in a long time.
Normally you could say that, you know, Southampton are mid-table. It just seems to have disappeared this season.
All right, so you got...
I would suggest that Southampton are the mid-table.
Okay.
On their own.
Right.
Yeah, the Premier League's famously three leagues in one, you know, the battle for top four, battle for mid-table and relegation. And Southampton have already have the middle one wrapped up.
Has there ever been a battle for mid-table?
Well, the battle not...
Newcastle have one, don't they, usually? Anyway, but I think you're absolutely right, Barry, because they are, what, 5 points below the teams with European aspirations, and they are 5 points above the teams who are trying to escape the shadowy clutches of the relegation. Anyway, so basically those games are Swansea going to West Ham, Fulham hosting Saints. They got beaten by Swansea, I just mentioned that. Arsenal are hosting Crystal Palace, who are now 4 points clear of the drop. Clever Crystal Palace. Cardiff are hosting Norwich. I mentioned that. You're not big on the powers of Kenwyn Jones to turn things around, but I think that's got to be a game they can win, no? Norwich are in a bit of a state, no? Or do they have a habit of pulling out results just when they need them? They do, don't they?
Norwich?
Yeah.
Always seem to be, yeah, just when it looks as if Chris Hughton's job might be under threat, they get a win or string a few draws together, so...
Always against the teams around them, that's the thing. Hull, who have now had four defeats in a row with no goals scored whatsoever in that run, will be hosting Spurs. They'll have their goalkeeper out, McGregor, because he got a red card. That's a big game for Hull because they are drifting perilously close. They're only 4 points above the drop. Anyway, Sunderland, for the first time, is it this season, Barry? The first time this season you're out of the relegation spots?
Off to Newcastle on Saturday
for
a Tyne-Wear derby, which is very important. I mean, Sunderland, Marcus Alonso and Ki Sung-Jung are looking like great new signings for them. Adam Johnson is also looking like a great new signing, even though he's been there a year and a half.
What's produced that turnaround, Barry?
Well, I don't know. There was talk that he has certain lifestyle issues. Fond of a pint, as am I. I'm not criticising him for it, but then I'm not a highly paid professional athlete. Whether or not he's sorted out, or maybe he's just hit form, who knows? There could
be
any number of reasons.
It's pints these days for Adam Johnson. As he racks up the goals, he's been involved in their last seven, I think.
Yeah, and that game's interesting as well, because just for reasons off the field, the two clubs have united, a rare show of solidarity, to shout, "Bah humbug at the police." Because
not just their horses this time.
No, the actual police on the horses. Because the kickoff was originally supposed to be at 3 p.m. and it was going to be a bubble match, which means Sunderland fans are only allowed travel by official transport. The police came out and said, well, it's nothing to do with us that the kickoff has been moved to 12:45. We never influence kickoff. And both clubs issued a joint statement saying that's a flat-out lie.
Really?
Yeah. So, and
but they haven't been able to move the kickoff, have they?
The kickoff is now going to be at 12:45, but it's not on TV. I mean, there is a chance there will be trouble at it, and there's been trouble before and quite recently, but you're always going to get idiots following every club in the world. And, you know, other big derbies have been played at 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, half 5, so, you know, why not this one?
The Genoa fans, interestingly, Genoa and Sampdoria, are on a similar note at United, they basically declared that they would go on strike for the upcoming Derby of the Lantern, Derby della Lanterna, because the game had been moved to a very early Sunday morning kickoff and to avoid problems with trouble between the sets of fans. And they put out a joint statement saying that we will not be supporting. I think they even threatened to withdraw their support for previous games as well in protest at this. And they said it's ridiculous. This is one of the Marassi Stadium, full of fans for the derby with the choreography and all the colours and stuff. It's actually a great advert. Why would you want to bury this away? You know, you put it out at 3 o'clock on the traditional kickoff time and let the world see it. And they haven't got their way because it's been moved to a Monday evening. But in principle, they're not getting it played early on a Sunday. So that's nice. Back to your game, though. And Newcastle coming into this without the services of Johan Kabay.
Or Loic Remy, who was sent off the other night.
Oh, in the Norwich game, was he?
Yeah, he sort of stuck the head on someone. I don't think he made contact, but, you know, addressed them with his forehead. And
that was a bit unfortunate, that red card, I thought.
I suppose it depends on your interpretation of the law. I'd say if you don't actually stick the nut on someone, then what's the harm? It's just posturing, isn't it?
Mm. Right. Well, so now Luke de Jong, he might be there?
I think that's gone through. Gone through on loan, yes.
What kind of player are we looking at there, Rafa?
He's a classic poacher, and that's why it didn't work
out
for
him. Uses vinegar, is that, as opposed to the little cup?
No. The reason why it didn't work out for him at Borussia Mönchengladbach is that Lucien Favre, the manager, doesn't really like that type of attacking midfielder. He likes more of the sort of number 10s, the deeper players who can come from wide positions. And he is an out-and-out box player. But he's very useful. Yes, he is Dutch, but it doesn't mean he's bad. I know there's a sort of
Hey?
Yeah, well, I mean, whenever a Dutch striker comes into the Premier League, then you get these things, yeah, he's Dutch, he can't be very good. He is actually pretty good, and I think it's a clever signing, certainly for a loan, because they can see effectively a six-month trial for him. If he's good enough, then they'll buy him. If not, they'll send him back.
Brilliant.
The Dutch striker thing, it's not necessarily about being Dutch, it's about Eredivisie, isn't it? Is it not? When you think back to Kerschman, who scored bags of goals over there, and then
Afonso Alves.
That's the other one.
Yeah, but I
think we referred to them once, what goals scored in the Eredivisie,
like
their equivalent in dog goals.
Right, yep.
It's about 4-1.
Fair enough.
But I must admit that kind of thinking did cloud my own judgment as well. Looking at Suarez for Ajax, I thought, yeah, okay, he takes 100 touches in the box, but it is Dutch football. No one's going near him. He surely can't be that special a player. And I think a lot of clubs, I was told, had the same reservations about it. And they thought, yeah, he's good, but can he play that way in a proper league where there's actually some defending going on.
Is Dutch defending actually worse than Premier League defending then? That's quite a scary thing.
Yeah, it's much, much worse.
Wow.
Much, much worse.
Whatever happened to
defending? Zlatan did all right after he left Ajax as well.
Actually, he didn't score for Asia. When he first went to Italy, he didn't score much at all. And the whole notion of him being a top scorer was a bit fanciful in those days. Now he's gone to France, of course. Anyway, what's going to happen in this Newcastle-Sunderland game? We don't know. Obviously, it's going to happen on Monday. We should just wait to find out. But do you have
Saturday.
A good feeling? Is it on Saturday?
It's Saturday lunchtime, yes.
Yeah, what did I say? Monday?
Yeah.
That's plain stupid, isn't it?
Oh, it was just an easy mistake to make. Chelsea game is on Monday.
Monday, of course, and we mentioned that. Yeah. Barry, you got a good feeling?
I have, actually, yeah. But I'd take a draw, but hopefully a win, especially with no Kabay. I think Newcastle are appealing Remy sending off, but I can't see it be overturned myself.
Peter Hunt! Tweeting in something for discussion on today's podcast. Sorry, Peter, we haven't got time. It was quite an interesting one about the situation at Leeds. Maybe we'll talk about that in the paper review. How about Martin Grindy? How do the pod fancy the chances of Colombia in Brazil now that Falcao is out? Well, that's one for later on in the season, isn't it? Graham King, got to be worth a mention of Grimsby ending Cambridge's home-winning streak on Tuesday. In the conference, they'd won 12 in a row at, what's that place called, Abbey Stadium? Abbey Stadium, I think.
And Max Rushton, to bring him up again, but he's a big Cambridge United fan, and he's traumatised at the moment, just by the prospect of promotion.
Right.
Because he knows it's they're going to...
He needs you now more than ever, Barry. Okay, and Joe Stevenson would love a mention for Adam Lafondra and his two hat-tricks in his last two home games. That's the 7-1 against Bolton, 5-1 v Blackpool. This is Reading we're talking about. And producer Ben points out John Guidetti scored three consecutive hat-tricks. Oh, but that was on loan at Feyenoord, so, you know, what's that? Where that's like one goal in three or something.
Where are they? Yeah.
Where? In Holland.
League, yeah.
And where's he now? He's at Stoke, but he can't get on the field. And his agent's kicking up a fuss about it or something. Yeah.
Well, wasn't there an interview with him in The Observer on Sunday?
Mm. Good. It was good, yeah?
Daniel Taylor did. Yeah, he's a very confident young man, Mr. Guidetti.
Mm. Excellent. Now, Bayern Munich. They came into this weekend 10 points clear in the Bundesliga with the game in hand. They played that game in hand Wednesday night. Stuttgart were their opponents.
And they were actual opponents for one of the rare occasions in this league. They really pushed them hard. They scored the first goal, Ibisevic. Bayern really struggled. Their passing was off. They had no rhythm. Stuttgart were doing all these little things like small fouls, getting them upset, disrupting the flow of the game, and it really got to Bayern. And then Pep did something that you thought you'd never see Pep do. He changed it to a formation with two strikers and almost played... I wouldn't say long balls, but they went very, very direct. Mandzukic came on, Pizarro came on just behind them, and Stuttgart, having exhausted themselves, running and pressing so hard, finally just a concentration level slipped, and Bayern scored from a header after a free kick and from a fantastic Thiago goal, which is worth checking out on YouTube or other available internet destinations with illegal moving pictures, at a scissor kick in injury time. And people saying, you know, that it's amazing because even when Bayern are quite bad, they still have this way of getting
quite bad, but one of the goals of the season there from Thiago, I thought it was an amazing goal.
Yeah, I mean, it did help that there was no one around him. He had a lot of time to set himself up, but it was a fantastic scissor kick, sort of at an angle.
It was also tilted. Him getting himself into a position where nobody was around
him. He had a great game, which I think perhaps is a point also worth making. It was his first goal for Bayern in the Bundesliga. And Toni Kroos, who's expected to do similar kind of stuff in the number 10 position, was substituted when that radical two-striker system was introduced by Pep. And he very angrily threw his gloves on the ground and refused to shake hands with, I think, the... assistant goalkeeping coach or something.
Right.
Anyway.
But Pep's not a man to bear a grudge or anything like that. So I've got two transfer-related questions. One is actually from AK, who tweets, Kroos, how likely is it he'll leave and do Bayern think he's expendable, especially after this glove incident?
I don't think the glove incident would be enough to change Bayern's basic view of him as somebody who will be a key figure in this Bayern game, especially going forward, because he's only 24.
Right.
And, you know, the Schweinsteigers and Lahms, they're on their way out slowly.
Mm.
So over the next 3 or 4 years, they wanted to keep him. But so far, he's refused to sign a contract. They're still quite a bit apart in terms of money of what Bayern see him as a realistic wage, and he does. I think there's still a chance he'll turn him down and go somewhere else. But it won't be in January.
Do you think Kroos actually would like to stay at Bayern if the money is right? So is it a financial thing? Or does he want to go possibly because he'd just like to... be somewhere else?
Very hard to say. I haven't seen anything from him that would suggest that his dream is to sort of play for a specific club or somewhere else. He's been around for a long time. He's already won things there. So it could very well be the case that he is genuinely looking for a new challenge. The thing is, though, there's such a good case to be made for just giving him that bit more money and knowing that you have a player who works in your system, who's used to what he's doing, rather than going out and buying another cross from somewhere else for 40 million euros, that I still think the most likely outcome is him renewing. And then he can still go in a couple of years' time. He'll only be 26, 27 then.
Mm-hmm. Right. Just 13 points the gap now. And the other question I had was, Mandzukic starting on the bench Mandzukic, rather, starting on the bench, was seen as very significant by some people who were eager to suggest that maybe that signified a likely transfer. Mm. Yes, no. Briefly. No, he's going to be staying there until the summer.
Briefly, give me a couple of sentences to
go on. Two sentences.
Well,
was it significant that he was on the bench?
It was significant because Matthias Sammer, the sporting director, again came out and said, yes, he showed a bit of reaction after being left out in the first game, but it's not enough. He needs to do more. So they're still not quite happy with what he's doing, and that is being reflected in his playing time. Mm. So in that sense, it's not just a tactical decision. They are sending him a message.
Right.
Does that mean he's necessarily off in January? Certainly not. Does it mean he's necessarily off in the summer? It's all down to him. If he accepts that Lewandowski is someone who's going to come in, who will probably be picked ahead of him a lot of times, then they're very happy to keep him because Pizarro is very old and will probably not be there. And Bayern need two strikers. As you saw, even Pep sometimes miraculously decides that two strikers are needed on the pitch. So they have no real incentive to get rid of him unless his behaviour is such that they feel is not worth having him around.
Super. All right, then 13 points, the lead now for Bayern in the Bundesliga. Quick final note on Italy, where Sunday night brings one of the classic, the Derby d'Italia, one of the classic fixtures, which is, of course, Juventus against Inter. A game, Barry, that could feature the footballing talents of Osvaldo, Nani, Pato, and maybe Hernanez as well. Not sure if you're familiar with Hernanez. The prophet, they call him down at Lazio, or at least they used to when he was good, but he's gone a bit off the ball of late. But anyway, that's quite crazy, some of the choices that Serie A clubs are making. Osvaldo heading back from Southampton to Juve, and Nani looks like it's a done deal for Inter, which is a bit of a surprise. And Pato now, the former Milan player.
The duck.
Very much the duck.
Is that really on, that deal?
I know. I'm not sure if that one's on, but there have been rumours, and they've been confirmed in Brazil, that Juve have asked Corinthians about the possibility
is
of bringing him back.
Is Pato still stepping out with
no
young?
No.
But he does have a child with her. Is that correct?
Do they? I don't think so. I don't think so.
Well, right. Maybe I'm wrong. I thought they were. All they right, had well, a child together, and that right. could be a reason for his return to Italy.
That's interesting.
You know.
We'll ask James Horncastle. It's not like we have an internet to hand or anything, so we'll wait till Monday and ask James Horncastle. The other big, but that's a very exciting game anyway, Juve-Inter, because Juve are 6 points clear on top, but dropped points last weekend, and Inter are currently in the Europa League positions, but it's all falling apart a bit there.
Would you say that Inter's chances have significantly increased now they've managed to sell Ranocchia?
Have they? Where's he gone?
I think he's going to Galatasaray, isn't he?
Ah, right, okay. Has that gone through? Yeah.
I'm not sure it has, but
No, that would probably help.
Suggestions.
That would probably help. But it's just a complete mess, and we've talked about this before, but they are in a complete mess, which is the ideal situation for them to come in and win that game away at the Juventus. I remember they did. Was it last season they went there and they were in complete shambles and they got the win? I mean, stranger things have happened.
And AC Milan, who are also in something of a mess, Adel Trapp,
yes.
How can I possibly make the situation better by bringing him in?
It's a marvellous decision for them to bring in Adel Trapp. He says he's honoured to be there.
I'm sure he is. Yeah. I'd say he can't believe
that
luck.
One really caught me by surprise, yeah. I don't think anyone looked at the Milan situation and went, ooh, but with Adel Trapp, the whole picture changes.
Well, I remember interviewing Neil Warnock last year, and he discussing the enigma that is Adel Trapp, and he insists that he's a splendid player, but he needs to be told, right, you are going to play the next 15 games, come what may, unless you get injured, you are going to start and finish the next 15 games, and then he will play. Now, he hasn't been getting that at Fulham. He's been very much a bit part player, much like he was at QPR as well, and I don't know, if Clarence Seedorf, I suppose, might be able to sort him out. But
if anyone can sort him out, it's Clarence Seedorf. Supposedly, the story is that Flavio Briatore, who always was a big Trapp fan, has had a word in somebody at Milan's ears about how it was Trapp that brought QPR out of the championship, and that being, you know...
And down again.
who knows, maybe it'll really work out, as will perhaps Helder Postiga going in at Lazio. Where their rivals Roma have been signing up all the best young players in the world. They've put some really interesting players. But that's a subject for another day, perhaps on Monday with James Horncastle. But that's it for today. Let me just mention, actually, that you can see a smattering of foreign papers on The Guardian's website from late Thursday, early Friday, if you will. You can also see that aforementioned Juventus-Inter with Raphael, James Horncastle, me, and that French fella on Sunday night. You know where to look. Barry, anything you want to throw our way?
Well, I'll be at TalkSport on Sunday morning, 11 to 1.
Lovely. Amy, what are you up to?
I'm going to Amsterdam.
Great. Is it for work?
Yes.
All right. Where can we read the consequences?
You'll have to wait till nearly Christmas.
Oh, next Christmas? Are you interviewing Santa?
Someone that magical.
That's it. Happy birthday, producer Ben. Many thanks to Barry Glendenning, Raphael Honigstein and Amy Lawrence. We'll catch up with you all on Monday.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code GUARDIAN.